Okay, welcome back to Cloak and Dagger. I'm your host, Lenny Bloom, along with Sherman Skolnick. And we're very, very honored to be briefed today now by one of the most top expert historians in America, and certainly, like myself and Sherman, a crime buster and crime fighter. And we're here at Cloak and Dagger once again to follow and keep on the heels of the path left by the criminal elite. And I want to welcome Mr. Eustace Mullins to Cloak and Dagger. Mr. Mullins, it's indeed a great honor to have you to share your wisdom with us.
Well, I'm very, very pleased to be on your show, but you didn't give me my best introduction, which was that I'm the last living protege of the poet Ezra Pound.
Yes, I'm sorry, you're right.
Four of his proteges got the Nobel Prize for Literature.
Absolutely, and
of course, you're the leading expert on the Federal Reserve.
Yes, I was introduced as that in Canada a few years ago when I got a rancher in Vernon.
You wouldn't mind, Eustace, if we call the current head of the Federal Reserve Alan Greenspan.
Alan Greenspan, yeah.
In some of my writings, I describe him that way, and some of the know-nothings, I'm sorry to say. Mr. Skolnick, why can't you call him by his proper name? What's this here about Alan Greenspan? My explanation is he is the same dictator like a Russian commissar.
Oh, he really is a commissar all the way.
A Soviet commissar.
A Soviet commissar, absolutely.
Tell us a little bit about your career, Eustace, and what you've been up to.
Well, I always tell my audiences that I got my education in an insane asylum, which is quite true. St. Elizabeth Federal Prison for the Insane in Washington, D.C., where I met the political prisoner Ezra Pound in 1948.
And were you just for our audience that are not familiar with your life, were you a political prisoner there at the same time?
No, but I was... on the verge of being a political prisoner most of my life. I was described by the Federal Bureau of Investigation as the most dangerous man of America. And they tried to have me committed to an insane asylum in 1959, but they didn't get very far.
Well, just Eustace, so that you get the feel of the show, we're forced to... sometimes be satirical and sarcastic on Cloak and Dagger, because we have to mix some of this hot information, which I know we're going to get into, with some cool information, usually just some humor and things, just to cool it down and so people don't get all frustrated and want to change the channel or go to another website.
Yeah,
Sherman, I just want to say this, that another great follower of Ezra Pound, a very good friend of mine, Marshall McLuhan, based his work on Ezra Pound, used to say that the only man who can actually prove his sanity is the man who has a discharge from a mental home.
Well, I've actually been judged competent by a number of leading psychiatrists in the United States. So I can run for any political office. I'm the only...
I'm sure there's you were very, very lucid all the time, and of course that's what gets us into trouble with the ruling elite.
Well, how did you get involved, Eustace?
Yeah,
in researching and investigating the Federal Reserve.
Well, I wasn't involved at all. I was a veteran of the U.S. Air Force during World War II, and I went to an art school in Washington D.C. and one of my instructors wanted me to go ahead and meet the poet Ezra Pound. And I said, well, I'm sure Ezra Pound has nothing to talk to me about, so I was reluctant to go. And they kept after me for about 6 weeks, and I finally went out, and we really hit it off together.
What were some of the enlightening changes of thought that he opened up for you?
Well, Ezra himself was a researcher. He had been researching on the causes of the First World War for 30 years in Europe. And he turned over all that information to me intact. And Ezra researched in 8 languages, so he was very versatile.
So really, his name should have been Ezra Tun.
Oh, yes. Well, a lot of people called him Ezra Pundit because that was the logical conclusion.
From that, you began your research on the Federal Reserve?
Well, he simply, see, Ezra was a political prisoner and was not allowed to leave the insane asylum, which was only a short distance from the Royal Library of Congress. So he asked me, since I had my freedom, if I would go to the library and see what I could find on the Federal Reserve System, which I had never heard of at that time, and I didn't know what he was talking about. But I did go down there, and I found out it was a criminal conspiracy. And he said, "You've stumbled on the greatest detective story of all time." And that was in 1948, and I'm still at it.
How did you pursue it from there?
I simply worked at the Library of Congress, and I met a number of congressmen. I met Congressman Wright Patman, who was chairman of the House Bank and Currency Committee.
Oh, yes, a great man.
Oh, yes. Well, Patman was a lone wolf all of his life, you know. No political figure in Washington dared to touch him, so he was always totally alone, and I was always welcome in his office, and he kept my book right on his desk at his office. And so he was one of a number of fine congressmen that I've met over the years.
Where did you proceed from there?
I stayed at the Library of Congress. I even became an employee of the Library of Congress.
Really?
Because I used to go there at 9 in the morning and stay till 9 at night every day.
What were some of the things that you uncovered?
Well, I uncovered the origins of the Federal Reserve System, that it originated not in Congress, but in a secret meeting, Thanksgiving week of 1910, at Jekyll Island, Georgia, at the private club of the richest men in the world. They represented at that time 1/6 of the wealth of the entire world, and they became a lot richer after they got the Federal Reserve System.
And they went to that meeting in the most clandestine manner, am I right?
Absolutely. They refused to tell anyone where they were going. These were very important men. And so the newspaper people were quite excited when they boarded a sealed train in Hoboken, New Jersey, and went to Brunswick, Georgia.
Yeah, these were the owners of the system.
Yes, they were the owners. They were the leading bankers of the United States.
Name a few of those. Let's see if we recognize their names.
Well, there was Paul Warburg, who was an employee of the House of Rothschild in Europe. And there was Frank Vanderlip, the president of the National City Bank, which is now Citibank today, one of our biggest banks. And the others were of like stature. There was about 8 or 10 of them.
Ultimately, on a surrealistic level, Warburg is a good name for sort of what really is the men from Iron Mountain, isn't it?
Oh, yes, it really
Warburg,
is.
Isn't it funny that that's the name says it all?
Oh, yes. In fact, his great-nephew, Freddie Warburg, became a good friend of mine, and in fact, helped me in my work.
So
that
was
Frederick's son.
What were you able to uncover about the going to the secret meeting and what they did there? What were you able to find out?
Well, I found out from Rupert Forbes, who was the leading financial writer of that time and the founder of Forbes magazine, which is quite a magazine today. Forbes stumbled on this secret meeting at Jekyll Island in 1910, and he wrote about it. And I got the original version of that, and I reprinted it in my Federal Reserve book in 1948.
What was their purpose that you found out?
Well, as Ezra described it to me, their purpose was to seize control of all the money and credit of all the people in the United States. And that's exactly what they did. And when they did that, they were able to start World War One, which they had been trying to get going since 1885, and nobody in Europe had the money to fight a world war.
Eustace, where exactly is this island, and what was the name of it again?
Jekyll Island, Georgia. The place is still there. I've been there many times. It's a beautiful resort, and it's now a private club, the Radisson Hotel of Jekyll Island. And it's at Brunswick, Georgia, where a number of people have died mysteriously over the years. There was a plane crash there some years ago, which took the life of the man who was up for Secretary of Defense, John Tower.
Right. So there was a lot of Jekyll and Hydes there.
There was a lot of Jekyll and Hydes, and I have been there. And the last time I was there, I came down with a mysterious illness and had a number of mini strokes. And I was lucky to get back alive. I haven't been back since.
I don't mean to jump ahead, but there is something there that maybe... Am I correct that Jimmy Carter's forebears had something to do around there?
Oh, yes, they were from that area. I don't know of any direct connection, but they had an interest.
Really?
So, and that's why Jimmy Carter was plucked from obscurity and named to the Bilderbergs of America and the Trilateral Corporation and became president of the United States.
So how did it proceed from that secret meeting? Tell us a few things that people could read more about in your book. But by the way, is your book still available?
Oh, yes, it's still available. It's still in print. It has never been reviewed. It has never been carried in any bookstore, and it's very much in demand.
Take a moment now to tell us where they can get it, and later in the program I want you to repeat that. Where can they get your book?
They can get it from Eustace Mullins. I have a website now, www.com, Eustace Mullins, and it tells you about getting the book there. And I can be reached at 126 Madison Place, Stanton, Virginia, which is the birthplace of Woodrow Wilson, who signed the Federal Reserve Act into law in 1913.
Repeat that, Eustace, slowly.
126 Madison Place, Stanton, Virginia.
Well, what's the zip?
24401.
All right, so what happened after the meeting in 1910? Tell us.
Well, honestly, the meeting was 1910. They didn't do anything for a while. You see, this was the National Monetary Commission, which had been appointed by President Theodore Roosevelt to bring a banking reform to the United States. These people were reformers. And in Jekyll Island today, they have a brass plaque in the hotel which states that these men were reformers and they met there to reform banking conditions in this country.
Really? Well, I think, if I remember right now, the excuse for this was they needed to do something to reform the banking situation in the United States because of the different money panics that had happened.
Well, the panic of 1907.
1907
was the immediate trigger.
The Knickerbocker Bank situation.
Oh, yes. And they went right to Roosevelt and said, we've got to do something about it. Jacob Schiff, who was the head of Kuhn Loeb at that time, and his great-granddaughter just married Albert Gore's daughter, married Albert Gore's son. So he's in very good company.
No, Albert Gore Jr.'s oldest daughter, Corinna, married Andrew Schiff, the great grandson of Jacob Schiff.
That's correct. And the Schiff fortune is still a very big fortune in the United States because that fortune was made before 1920. And so people who made money in those days kept most of it.
They became, maybe we're jumping too far ahead, but they split up the Fed. Well, tell us a little bit about the formation of the Federal Reserve.
Well, it was designed to be 12 semi-autonomous units, 12 districts of the United States. The we have 50 states in the United States, but see, withdrawn again. Instead of states, we have 12 Federal Reserve districts.
And the most important one is the New York Federal Reserve, am I right?
The New York Federal Reserve controls the whole thing. The others are simply window dressed against one. I quoted one a critic in my book who says that the other 11 districts are simply window dressing for the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, which runs the whole system.
So far as I know, the only ownership records ever published was in 1976 by a subcommittee of Congress.
Oh, that's correct.
And if I remember, correct me if I'm mistaken, but there were 12 different plutocrat families that own the New York Federal District Reserve.
Yes, that's Rockefeller Warburg, Schiff, and a number of others. The Harrimans, of course, and the Harrimans, you know, are the patrons of the Bush family, which has produced two presidents for us.
Were they sort of a latter-day version of the Bank of the United States that was three different times, and then they were put under? Of course, that was long before that by Andrew Jackson.
Well, it was always the same people who were involved. They were always trying to commit. Well, they had the first Bank of the United States, which Thomas Jefferson refused to renew the charter, and they started the War of 1812 to punish the United States for not renewing the charter of this first central bank. And that was the only reason for the War of 1812. And then Andrew Jackson withdrew the government deposits from the second Bank of the United States, which is a central bank, a second central bank. And when he withdrew those government deposits, the bank collapsed, and so the Bank of England enacted the Panic of 1837, during which all securities of the United States were deemed not worthy of being cashed in. So they were worthless as a result of this edict of the Bank of England. And so the some of the wealthy families brought up these things for 10 cents on the dollar and created the first millionaires in the history of the United States.
What some people find interesting is about a little bit after the formation of this, it's a private central bank, am I correct?
Privately owned, yes. It's private. And that's totally against the Constitution of the United States, which says that Congress will have control of the money.
Yeah, because can I just add that really what we're saying here is that what really would normally be stock certificates of a private corporation now turn into our currency down here?
Yes, that's right. That's monetization of debt is all it is.
So the first thing that the Federal Reserve did...
Slavery.
...was to put... the expenses of Europe's war onto the people of the United States. Is that correct?
Well, that's exactly correct, because the people of Europe could not afford war anymore. They were bankrupt. They'd been trying to have a war since 1885, and they finally got one in 1914 after our Congress enacted the Federal Reserve Act of 1913.
And, of course, J.P. Morgan, that was instrumental in the Federal Reserve. Am I correct?
Yes. Private secretary was at the meeting of Jekyll Island.
Yeah, and in effect, what it has the resultant effect is, would you agree, is that the value of the labor, sweat off the brow of the American people, doesn't wind up in their own coffers, it winds up in somebody else's?
Oh, yes, it doesn't stay in this country at all. And that money goes right back to Europe, to what they call Venetians in Europe who've been running this thing for over 1,000 years.
Most of the years,
exactly,
until recently,
yeah.
J.P. Morgan had a British flag flying in front of their headquarters,
yeah,
in Wall Street.
Oh, yes, and J.P. Morgan's home in London is now the U.S. Embassy.
State secrets are right under their noses, just as I said, Sherman. The state secrets are right just under their noses.
For those that haven't read your book and maybe even believe that the Federal Reserve is a government bank, which it's not, at what point can you point to a more or less a specific point at which the U.S. paper currency was switched over to this other fake currency called Federal Reserve notes? When did that start like that?
Well, they made a number of steps which were finalized in 1944 when we were involved in the Second World War, and Congress removed the last gold backing of the dollar. It was since 1944, it has only been backed by paper bonds. So you have paper currency backed by paper bonds.
No, but when did they start circulating the paper money as Federal Reserve notes?
Oh, 1914. They printed the Federal Reserve notes in 1914. You see, the Federal Reserve Bank, being a central bank, was a bank of issue, and that was the entire purpose of enacting the Federal Reserve Act was to give us a central bank, which would be a bank of issue, which would issue money.
Well, but wait, let me understand this. Prior to 1914, the U.S. government printed their own paper called U.S. dollar?
Well, the banks did it. The national banks did it. And the only time that the government printed their own money was in during the Civil War, when President Abraham Lincoln had the greenback currency printed to finance the war, and they assassinated him for that. And then John F. Kennedy comes along 100 years later and decides that he will print greenback currencies and bring back the prosperity of this country.
Well, he found a loophole in the law, which some of us write about, to issue quite a quantity of $2 bills.
Yes. A greenback currency.
And the media, of course, always laughed at the $2 bills, but the real purpose was to marginalize that type of U.S. paper money. In other words, other than the $2 bill, by the time of 1963, there wasn't any U.S. paper currency.
No, there were Federal Reserve notes. These were Federal Reserve notes. And you see, people would see that on top of their bills. They'd pull out their wallet and pull out a Federal Reserve note, and they would believe that it was federal. But the Federal Reserve system has never been federal, and it has never had any reserves because it prints its own money, so you don't really need reserves when you produce your own money. And it was never a system. I have publicly identified it for 50 years as a not a system, but a criminal syndicate.
Hold on. Before we get away from the point, I want to just ask Eustace this. Eustace, would you then say that John Kennedy could be regarded, his role was that of the Robin Hood in a feudal medieval setting?
Yes, he was a Robin Hood, and he was advised to do this because he asked his advisors, what can I do with my legacy? You know, presidents always worry about that. And so one of his advisors told him, if you can get the Federal Reserve Act off the back, the Federal Reserve system off the backs of the American people, they'll have statues of you in every hamlet in the United States.
And that came, and that got mediated through the system and came out in the form of Camelot, and the whole Camelot image within the culture certainly came from that as well, right?
That came from that, and that's why he and Jackie are remembered for Camelot, and they don't realize that it was his crusade against the Federal Reserve System which created
And Richard
Camelot.
Burton, and it gave rise certainly also to the Richard Burton, Elizabeth Taylor, and the whole Lerner and Lowe stream within the theater world.
Well, it certainly did.
To back up a little bit.
Julie Andrews, Richard Burton, etc.
To back up a little bit, Eustace, tell us what you may know about that one congressman starting about 1930 that in his speeches in Congress condemned the Federal Reserve.
Oh, Louis McFadden. I knew of people who knew Louis McFadden well, and they said, oh, Louis McFadden was absolutely insane because he went up against the system. And he, Wright Patman, he spoke out alone against the Federal Reserve System. No one dared to support him in it.
Yeah, I've seen there is a website that has replicated some of his speeches.
His speeches are great.
And the other thing is, if I remember, Congressman McFadden also condemned the Secretary of the Treasury, did he not?
Yes, he did.
And that was who?
That was Eugene Meyer.
Yeah.
He was director of the Federal Reserve System. He wasn't the...
Let's go into that briefly. Eugene Meyer, I've written about that. Have you got that in your book also?
Yes, I have the Eugene Meyer. I still have a microfilm of the hearings on Eugene Meyer to be a governor of the Federal Reserve Bank. And I got that at the Library of Congress.
So tell me if my understanding is correct as you understand it. Eugene Meyer swindled and embezzled millions and millions of dollars of Liberty bonds that the U.S. issued during World War One and thereafter, and then used that money to buy the bankrupt Washington Post early in the 1930s.
Yes,
and
he did.
And, of course, his daughter became Catherine Graham.
Yes, she married Philip Graham, but she was the inheritor of the Post.
But, the bottom line, to quickly put it, is that the Washington Post is based on embezzled, swindled money.
Oh, it is. As head of the War Finance Corporation, Eugene Meyer printed war bonds in duplicate. He printed one copy for the American people and one copy for himself.
Oh,
and so he got exactly half of the income of the War Finance Corporation. And with that, he bought the Allied Chemical Company, and he bought the Washington Post. He bought a lot of things. He became enormously wealthy.
Let me ask this. It's probably a stupid question, but I'll ask it. It's a frivolous question. Did the Washington Post ever have anything good to say about you and your book?
They never mentioned me. And I used to have lunch with the editor of the Washington Post every day. He was a member of our circle at the old Thompson's Cafeteria there on Pennsylvania Avenue.
Really?
And he's retired now, living in Maine.
Was the Federal Reserve, in your judgment, instrumental in some way in the Second World War as well?
Oh, yes, it was very important because, you see, Roosevelt had to get us into the war, and he financed the giving the destroyers to England and helping England stay alive. That was all done with Federal Reserve money.
I'm ready to believe that you're probably one of those, Eustace, that does know and understand that there was prior knowledge to Pearl Harbor.
Oh, absolutely. There's prior knowledge to everything. Nothing happened. Well, Roosevelt himself said nothing happens by accident.
Yeah.
I mean, when you're gambling with billions of dollars, you don't want any accidents. You want everything to work out just the way you planned it.
Yeah. All the world's a stage.
Yes.
Eustace, you probably became aware of a decision within the last maybe 8-10 years or so. Somebody fell down on the steps of the Federal Reserve building in San Francisco and sued the U.S. government for negligence, and the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit in San Francisco ruled that she cannot sue the federal government because the Federal Reserve is a private enterprise not connected to the U.S. government.
Well, of course it is.
I know it's the only direct decision on the question of the Federal Reserve. Am I right?
It's the only direct decision, but the Federal Reserve banks themselves do not pay any taxes because they're private institutions.
Eustace?
Yes.
Sherman, let me just ask a couple of technical questions that have hit me. Did they outsource the minting process? The minting process of currency would have been something that they would have to, right from the beginning, have taken and done in-house. Is it still done in-house, and has it been, or was it ever outsourced, just the printing of the money, the minting, in effect?
As far as I know, it was still printed directly by the Division of Currency, the Division of Printing and Engraving, right there on 14th Street. In fact, it's right next to the U.S. Holocaust Museum, as a matter of fact.
Well, they now have a new printing plant in Fort Worth.
Oh, yes. I think Fort Worth, most of the printing is done there for the last 15, 20 years.
And that's a company. Now, wait, Sherman, hold on. I want to ask another question. The currency, therefore, is basically like other corporations issue common shares of the company. The currency is basically like a common share, is it? Or is it a common share with a no vote? No vote common share?
It would be a no-vote common share, absolutely.
Yeah. what they
tell the public,
and they own all the preferred shares that carry votes, right?
Yes, but they don't tell the public anything. So the public doesn't know anything.
Sherman, have you got that other American currency in your wallet?
Those sons and daughters of the very wealthy that go to schools like the Wharton School of Business and so on, they come out, they graduate, and if you ask about the Federal Reserve, they says, no, the member banks own the Federal Reserve.
Oh, yes, the member banks do. That's quite right.
And, of course, if you ask, well, wait a minute, what about the one in New York, the New York Federal Reserve District Bank? No. There's nobody owns that.
Oh, I've got all that information in my book. I got that from the Federal Reserve System in 1955, as a matter of fact, when I reissued the book.
You know, if they allowed us on a major television show Eustace, you and me and Lenny.
It's a bomb.
We could make so many jokes about the Federal Reserve, we would actually be entertaining, wouldn't we?
Well, we would be the best show in town. But you see, I have caused the demise of a lot of talk show hosts because of it. And when Martin Downey Jr. had the fastest-growing television show in the United States,
did,
a friend of mine got me to appear on his show and talk about the Federal Reserve System. And the next day, they canceled all of Martin Downey's advertising contracts, and he's never had another show since. He was bankrupt.
Well, that's why. That's of course the problem with the media, the mass media folks. That if they show ads, you know that whatever you hear from them is not going to be the truth.
Lenny, Eustace has got a point there. We should figure out one of the talk show people that promote the big lie. And we should trick him into putting Eustace Mullins on, and that would be the end of that talk. So.
Well, Martin Downey was tricked into having me on. He had no idea who I was or what I represented. And so I appeared on his show, and that was the end of his career.
But tell us a little bit more about the Federal Reserve. In other words, they get the paper money and the bonds, and they sell it to the Treasury.
Oh, they sell everything.
They make a profit at it.
Absolutely, they make a profit, everything. It costs, I think, 2 cents to print a $100 bill, and when they...
Yeah, and all they are is a middleman.
They're a middleman.
They're just a bunch of middlemen.
Here in Chicago, the Federal Reserve, I don't know if they've moved, but they were always on a little narrow street, as narrow as an alley, downtown Chicago.
Well, you know what? I was never...
The head of the Chicago Federal Reserve, traditionally, now get this, was also the head of the Tribune Company that publishes 56 newspapers, radio and TV, the Chicago Tribune, the L.A. Times. And of course, they would never print the truth about the Federal Reserve because the head of the Chicago Federal Reserve is traditionally the head of the Tribune Company. I mean, that's an interesting tie-in, isn't it?
Well, it is quite a conflict there. And, of course, you remember Edith Rockefeller McCormick was part of the Rockefeller family that put the Federal Reserve together, and she was one of the biggest operators in Chicago.
The other thing is that the public should understand, and I suppose you have it in your book, that when you want to buy not a savings bond from the Treasury, but one of the bonds that trades up and back in the secondary market, U.S. Treasury bills, notes,
oh, the bills,
bonds,
yes.
You got to go and buy it from the Federal Reserve as an agent.
Absolutely. You buy everything. They don't give anything away.
But isn't that, I believe you probably point out in your book that it's unconstitutional for the Treasury to have a private sales agent for their goods.
Well, the Treasury was replaced by the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, which officially designated the Federal Reserve System as the fiscal agent of the United States, which was unconstitutional because the Constitution set up a Treasury of the United States, and well, the Federal Reserve Act simply dismissed that, threw them out.
And the other thing, of course, is that the common people of this country believe that the government changes the interest rates when it's the Federal Reserve that changes it.
No, the Board of Governors changes the interest rates, the rate span, as you say.
Yeah, the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve.
Yes.
No
congressman. In fact, the Federal Reserve has always boasted that it was independent of Congress.
Yeah, they didn't lie. We told them the truth.
Absolutely. They've always been independent.
Now, I don't know how much you listen to radio, but there's a guy that's on in major cities on Saturday and Sunday as a great financial pundit, Bob Brinker.
I never heard of him.
Every time he's on, he praises Alan Greenspan.
For heaven's sake.
He calls him the maestro. He knows exactly what he's doing, and he's perfectly honest. What is your opinion?
Well, Greenspan was a partner of J.P. Morgan Company when they made him governor of the Federal Reserve Board. He came right out of J.P. Morgan Company, which was one of the original conspirators at Jekyll Island.
And in 1966, Greenspan wrote a book praising gold, but then when he got into the Federal Reserve as the head, he talks against gold and in favor of paper money.
Yes.
I call him the paper money crowd. Well, what do you call them?
Well, I don't call him anything. I call him a former partner of J.P. Morgan.
I call him Mr. Hyde. It's Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
It certainly is. Oh, yes.
He looks like Mr. Hyde.
Oh, yes.
Tell us something that's humorous or entertaining or a big dirty joke about the Federal Reserve, something that we'll remember.
Well, I used to go into the Federal Reserve building a lot on Pennsylvania Avenue, the palace, the marble palace that they have on Constitution Avenue at 21st Street. And I used to go in there and talk to Joseph Cohen, who was the chief administrator of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors. And he was very anxious to talk to me because I was the principal enemy of the Federal Reserve System, inherited it from Congressman Wright Patman. So I would go in without an appointment and go right to his office. And the first time I called him from downstairs, his secretary said, "Well, Mr. Cohen cannot see you without an appointment." And I said, "Well, I'm parked on a parking meter outside on Constitution Avenue, and I only have a few minutes." So she said, "Well, he'll see you for a few minutes then." And I went up, and I couldn't get away from him.
Mr. Wait a second. You're telling us, so we got Mr. Warburg, and we got Mr. Coin, who's down at looking after all the coins?
Well, it's C-O-I-N-E, Coin.
I know, but it's Mr. Coin, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, he's the money man.
Yeah, Mr. Coin's the money man. Well, that's how he got his name.
Oh, yes, but he was a typical bureaucrat because he does nothing but bureaucracy. He never sees any money. I never saw any money in the Federal Reserve building on Constitution Avenue.
Are you aware of this little anecdote? Some of these people, tax protesters and others, that are against the Federal Reserve, they used to go to the Treasury and says, no, I want genuine U.S. paper money. And so somebody at the Treasury used to pacify them by giving them some $2 bills, the one that used to say, U.S. currency across the top.
Oh, yeah.
In other words, they said, well, here, you can have some of these, that's just, Eustace, tell us, if it's pertinent, whose idea was it to put the pyramid with the all-seeing eye on the back of the Federal Reserve paper baloney money?
Ooh. Well, no one can trace anybody who had any authority whatsoever to do put any of those symbols on our face. And the paper money, the symbols are on there for a very important purpose, but nobody will admit to ever having any responsibility for it.
I thought that Franklin Roosevelt ordered that.
Well, he may have, but you see, he had Henry Morgenthau as his Secretary of Treasury.
Well, just tell us briefly what you understand those symbols mean.
Well, those are occult symbols. They're symbols of ancient civilizations, and they go all the way back to Babylon. And, it's no accident that our troops are in Babylon today.
Really?
Yeah, good point.
Some people that were very sarcastic used to look at the back of that. You see that eyeball there? I said, whose eyeball is that? Catherine Graham, whose father embezzled the Liberty Bonds and with that money bought the bankrupt Washington Post. That's Catherine Graham's eye. Yes, it looks just like her eye.
Well, his partner was Bernard Baruch, who, of course, was the counsel to presidents.
If you don't mind, I call him the late swindler, Bernard Baruch.
Well, I had the pleasure of sitting behind a movie in the Fifth Avenue Playhouse once and watching the rerun of the House of Rothschild, and they told me that I was sitting behind this tall man with five people now with him. He had a nurse and he had three bodyguards. And so I asked the ticket taker when I went out, I said, "Wasn't that Bernard Baruch in there?" And he says, "Yes, he comes over every afternoon and watches the movie again."
So we're talking about the counsel to the owners of the system.
Yes.
What's great, and the reason we have such great honor to have you on our program, Eustace, here we have you who somehow crossed the path of all these embezzlers and swindlers who, in high places with their phony money backed by nothing. It's absolutely amazing.
I mean, a promise to pay a promise to pay a promise.
Yeah, I mean, it's a...
It is a promise to pay, but a promise doesn't pay anything.
Yeah, and a promise to pay a promise to pay a promise is like air.
By the way, currently, I think the dollar is going to hell. Are we coming to a time when people are going to look at at the Federal Reserve and say, "I don't know, haven't you got anything better than that to offer?"
Well, you know, a lot of times people take me out to dinner, and when we go to pay the cashier, they'll say, I'm sorry, but I don't have anything but a Federal Reserve note to pay this bill with. And the cashier will say, well, she'll call the manager, and the manager will say, come up and say, well, we can't take a Federal Reserve note.
A very cynical person once gave me a package there for Christmas. I opened it up, and it was a roll of toilet paper printed with the Federal Reserve notes on it.
Oh, I've seen copies of those. I don't have any, but it's a very it's a wonderful gift idea for this time of the year.
But for cynical people, it gives them great delight to actually use that toilet paper.
Oh, I guess it does. But it's very official looking, and it gives them a people used to light cigars with $5 bills during the flush times of the 1920s, and so this is sort of much the same thing.
If we were a commercial radio program, Eustace, this would be our last show because we dared put you on.
Oh, absolutely. Because
it'd be the end of us.
Just a second. Every time we've walked that line, Sherman. We put on Von Bulow and got blasted off of Mojo. Eustace, we were on a commercial blowtorch station, 50,000 watts in Toronto. Go ahead, tell them the story, Sherman.
No, but Eustace, my idea is, from a very cynical standpoint, is to, you don't mind that I put it really blunt, to sick you onto some establishment talk show host to put an end to it once and for all.
Well, I've put an end to about 50 in the last 25 years.
Yeah, we'd like to send you
I never did it with any intent in mind, but they would just simply vanish from the scene after that.
Eustace, you got to have a business card printed, and under your name, you got to put down talk show host Terminator.
No. Media critic.
Media critic. Counselor to Dan Rather.
Dan Rather, psychiatrist. You're his psychiatrist. He would.
What other anecdotes can you tell us about the Federal Reserve?
Well, you know, I never went near the Chicago Federal Reserve when I was in Chicago. I didn't even know about it. I never heard of it.
It's on this little forbidding alley. The street is so narrow, it's an alley. And the side entrance is like going into a secret building of some kind.
It must be secret, because I never saw it.
You know, Eustace, Sherman is not telling you the truth. Sherman fails to tell you that the reason why we've had you on today is because Sherman has a headache pill company.
Oh, yeah, we got it.
And you see, he really is interested only in selling his headache pills, nothing more.
If he brings you
and me on, then he really does increase his sales.
Our critics claim that Lenny and I have a secret interest, that we are the sales...
Owners. No, we're the owners of a major headache pill company.
Overseas headache pill company.
A worldwide international headache pill company.
And we run these programs like people with you, to criticize the government, to promote our product.
Yeah.
By the way, our company originally had as a director the former Adolf Hitler.
Well, we took over IG Farben with a public offer, a hostile one, and we won. And a matter of fact, IG Farben's going to be making a public offer for Kissinger and Associates soon.
Well, they're always talking about George Bush, the present president, that he and his father were mixed up in the eugenics movement with a lot of people during the early 20s, which was very close to Adolf Hitler.
I mean the Harrimans and such.
Yeah, the Harrimans. The Harrimans were very active in that eugenics movement.
Eustace, do you think there will come a time when we Americans will be back to having genuine U.S. paper money instead of this other...
Cut out the middleman. Sherman wants to know how long it's going to be before Americans cut out the middleman, stop paying retail, right,
yeah.
Sherman? Get it wholesale.
I mean, we're using green toilet paper now.
We certainly are. But China has started to dump the U.S. debt, and so is Japan. So we might not have a dollar much longer.
Really?
Yes, Japan and China are both moving to reduce their holdings of U.S. dollars, which could be the beginning of the end.
They're cutting out the middleman too, Sherman.
Well, I know, but realistic people used to say, yeah, I know the Federal Reserve paper is not the real stuff, but for the time being, any of the paper that you don't want, I got this bushel here. Throw all the stuff that you don't want into my bushel. I'll use it, even though it's green toilet paper, but I'll use it.
Well, Japan and China were simply buying the U.S. debt to keep the U.S. going so that they could sell their products over here.
Listen, Eustace, if we took, I have a plan now. You know, the money is all printed. I've seen the American money. It's all printed on paper. If we were to lock down a technology such that each dollar bill glowed and flashed and had a little TV screen in it, if every single new bill could be issued with a television set in the bill, do you think we could make the American dollar popular again?
Well, I don't want to make it popular again. There's no production behind it, you see.
Like, trouble with the American currency is, have you seen it? It's non-electric. It doesn't glow. It doesn't flash. There's no TV in it.
We are forbidden to talk about that because they're working on that technology now. We promise to be silent about
that. A small little... Well, exactly. I mean, see, Sherman's working on this technology so that every little bill is replaced with a bill that's got a TV, and everything you look at it, it glows, it flashes, it gets... They'll love it, and he's going to make a public offer for the Fed using his headache pill business to take over the Fed, and then he's going to grab this product, right, Sherman? The one with the glow bill? And then that's it. Take over the world with glow bills from the Fed owned by Sherman.
Let me just tell you, I'll take a minute or two. There was an interesting case here among what I call the banker judges. The important judges are bankers, by the way.
They're bank stock owners.
And they had an important case that should have been in all the newspapers, but was only mentioned in the lawyer's newspaper. And here's what happened. There was a character there that developed a chemical that takes the words off of the money, and he takes a $5 bill, and he makes it into a $100 bill by putting other words on it. And he was being prosecuted for counterfeiting, and the illustrious banker judges tied with the Fed turned him loose. They says, no, that's not counterfeiting, because he was using the real money. He just put different words on it.
Oh, that's not counterfeiting. Absolutely, those judges were correct.
I don't know, but there was something screwy about that decision, Eustace.
Well, something screwy about all the judges' decisions. Look at the Supreme Court for the last 50 years.
Yeah, they're banker judges. Some of them are tied to the Federal Reserve, yeah.
Oh, you know, I was advised to get the financial statements of the judges whenever I went into court. Bill Benson told me to do that. And so I started getting the financial statements, and they all have bank stocks.
In your judgment, is there a tie-in, because it happened in the same approximate period, that they pushed through, under the strangest circumstances, the 16th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which set up the mysterious IRS, which really has very few statutes. It's mostly that they set their own rules. In your opinion, is there a tie-in between the 16th Amendment that formulated the income tax, mostly for common people, and the Federal Reserve? Is there some connection there?
Oh, I've lectured with Bill Benson. Bill Benson goes around lecturing in this country. He spent years researching that. He's published a book. His book has all the information on that.
I've got the two-volume set. I have.
Yeah, two-volume set. It's
but in other words, is there a connection directly with the federal with the secrecy of the Federal Reserve, the way that 16th Amendment was pushed through by strange means?
Oh, yes, that was all tied in together. And, you know, Bill says in his book that every legislature which ratified the 16th Amendment did so illegally because they never had the...
He traveled all over to the 50 states that he died
in. Yes, he really did. He put in the legwork on it. And so the IRS is totally without validity.
Eustace, in the remaining minutes, just tell us briefly, what is the most outrageous thing that we could tell some naive acquaintance of us about the Federal Reserve, something really outrageous.
Well, you know, I was lecturing before a tax protesters group in California a couple of years ago, and we had three prominent guys there who appeared and told how they had fought the IRS with very expensive lawyers that cost them about $35,000 apiece, and won. And then I stood up and said, well, I went before U.S. tax court and represented myself, and they gave me a letter that I had no tax deficiency. And they never invited me back after I told them that.
What puzzles me, Eustace, is you said you used to have lunch occasionally with some of the same characters that ate near you or with you that were the editor of the Washington Post?
Oh, yes. We had a group called the Tannenbaum Club, which met at Thompson's cafeteria every day. With one of the men was George Stimson, who founded the National Press Club, and another was the editor of the Washington Post at that time. And we had J.M. Lally, who was the classical editor of the Washington Post. He was a classicist. And so we had a very distinguished company that I met every day.
Now, when you say a classicist, you mean that he's been a good student of the trivium and done some perceptual training? Is that sort of what you mean by that term?
No, he's a student of classical civilization, ancient Rome and Greece.
Oh, but so not really.
You can write all you want to about ancient Rome and Greece, and you never get in trouble.
Yeah, exactly.
Is how they could... Were they aware of everything that you do, and they didn't almost choke on their food while you were nearby? I mean,
well, I hadn't published my book at that time,
so I
hadn't become notorious yet. They just thought I was a very bright student and a nice guy to have around, which I was.
Now, but, in other words, you wouldn't. They wouldn't feel free to have you sitting and eating lunch with them now.
Well, they're long gone from Washington anyway.
But I mean, even their counterparts now.
Oh, their counterparts wouldn't have anything to do with me. I haven't been in the press club in years.
Oh, you're a treasure. Eustace, tell us again where they can get your book and communicate with you.
Oh, they can get it through my website, which is eustacemullins.com.
Spell it, Eustace.
EustaceMullins at www.com.
And you have an address where they could communicate if they wish?
Yeah, he'll have everything at this site. That's all he has to do, Sherman.
Yes, everything's all over.
Everything's at EustaceMullins.com, period.
Yes, everything. And that's up and running. We just got it set up, and it's running right now.
Do you tell your trusted funds they should throw their Federal Reserve notes away because they're phony?
Well, they know they're phony, but they don't throw anything away. It's all the money they've got. Yeah, and after all, it is legal tender. They had an act of Congress to make that stuff legal tender.
Really?
Because under
law... Eustace, can we swap links?
Well, I think so.
Good. Okay. I'll talk to you after the briefing.
All right.
Eustace, it is a great honor to have somebody as distinguished as you on our program.
Well, I love talking in Canada anyway, and I've been up there for a while because they've been looking for me, and they swear that they're going to deport me when I come into Canada.
Well, no, this program goes by internet radio all over the world.
Oh, that's wonderful.
You know, Eustace, next time you're on, speaking of Canada, what we should talk about is imperial commerce and the history of imperial commerce and its effects.
Oh, yes. And admiralty law, of course.
We got to have you out again, Eustace, here.
Yes, well, we're just getting started here.
You're a treasure.
Well, I love sharing this information. So I went to the insane asylum and found out all this stuff, and so I want to share it with other people because not everybody goes to the insane asylum every day the way I used to.
By the way, is there some anti-Federal Reserve society that sells vacation tickets to Jekyll Island?
No. In fact, a friend of mine had a meeting there a few years ago, and it was very successful. And Frank Vanderlip III turned up, the grandson of Frank Vanderlip. And I had dinner with him at the Jekyll Island Club. And so later on, after the dinner, I stood up and lectured on the origins of the Federal Reserve. And Vanderlip was furious and stormed out. Because he thought I was there to praise these wonderful banking reformers, you see, because they really believe that sort of thing. And
Wait, you're saying that they really thought they were doing good? I mean, to us it seems that they knowingly were conspiring against the common people of America.
Well, they certainly were, but they were doing themselves good. You know, they say, you do well by doing good. And that's what they were doing.
One final question. Do you believe that regarding Bush and some of the things that are happening now, that insofar as the Federal Reserve is an part of the aristocracy, that there may be a split in the aristocracy, the different families that run the Federal Reserve don't all agree with one another?
Oh, they certainly don't. Freddie Warburg, the grandson, who was the great nephew of Paul Warburg, certainly was a friend of mine, and he actually helped me out with money because he was loaded.
So in other words, they're not a monolith.
No, they're not monolithic at all. But they have disagreements constantly. And, of course, they have terrible battles over their estates when their parents die.
Maybe it's too complicated of a question, but can you point to what part of the Federal Reserve bosses are for Bush and which group may be against them, or is that too hard of a question?
Oh, that's not a hard question at all, because they have to be for all the candidates. They can't have a candidate whom they're not supporting financially, because the only money that they can run for office on in the United States is Federal Reserve notes.
But I mean, about the different situations like now with Bush, some of us believe that there's a split in the aristocracy, including the Federal Reserve. Is that a valid understanding or not?
Oh, I don't think it's valid at all. I think it's quite monolithic and quite united. And this Kerry Bush political campaign, which just concluded, well, the newspapers headline every day, Kerry attacks Bush and Bush attacks Kerry. And they weren't attacking each other because they were both members of Skull and Bones. They were fraternity brothers.
On this program, we're rather blunt, so you wouldn't mind that we call the Federal Reserve Building in Washington the Great Marble Toilet.
Well, that would be one description. But, you know, they treated me very nice, and when I went to the Federal Reserve Building, to their private library, I found that they had every edition of my book there. And so, after all, that's very flattering to an author, you know. And whenever I put out a new edition, I was always getting an order from the Federal Reserve System for my new book. And it wasn't advertised. It wasn't reviewed.
Yeah.
So how did
yeah.
they know that the book was available?
Well,
in the
Soviet Union, they send them to Siberia, and North America, they ignore you, and that was the Siberia, their wilderness. But they wanted to have a few copies so that they, I mean, that's priceless.
But would they honor your request? I'm willing to sell you the book, but you got to send me genuine money. Not your green toilet paper.
Yeah, gold, hard currency.
No, you don't offend your customers by making demands like that. But, you know, they kept me under observation whenever I was in the Federal Reserve Building, and they sent a guard to watch me. And it made me nervous. And I quit going there.
Well, what did they suppose you were going to do?
Well, they didn't know. Maybe I had a bomb with me. I had a briefcase, which, of course, they looked into when I went in and out. This was before the terrorism, so I don't think they even looked at my briefcase.
Eustace, we're honored to have you on this program. You have done your part in trying to help free common Americans from being slaves to the Federal Reserve and their paper, their toilet paper. We're really honored to have you. You brought a treasury of wisdom to our program, and we would be honored to have you again. And
well, it's a great opportunity for me,
work.
Because if I don't tell other people what I know, it doesn't go anywhere. So I have to keep informing people. After all, Ezra Pound had me write this book. You know, he commissioned this book. It's the only book I know that Ezra Pound ever commissioned from any writer. And so I have to keep circulating the book to justify his 13 years of imprisonment without trial when he asked me to do the book.
Really?
So I call my book Ezra Pound's Revenge because of the illegal imprisonment.
Keep up your work, Eustace.
I certainly will.
We're really honored. I hope you get a lot of traffic on your website and that they purchase your book, and that they learn something about how there has been an effort to enslave the American people and make them beholden to this marble building there.
I don't think it's been an effort to enslave the people at all. I think the people are very happy being enslaved. I don't hear any objection from anybody. I mean,
you know, Leonard Cohen has a song everybody knows, and it's just really about the collective subconscious and how everybody knows on that level. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Well, that's true. There is a, in nature, there's a common knowledge among everybody.
Yeah.
And that sort of persists. In fact, I don't think life would be possible without it.
I think we've come to the end of our segment, have we, Lenny?